Welcome, guys, to episode 65 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name's James Gearing, and this week I am over the moon to bring Sebastian Junger back to the podcast. He was one of my first guests when I first started up, which was mind-blowing in itself, and he was kind enough to reconnect a couple of weeks ago for this recording. So we talk about an array of subjects. We revisit one of my favorite books on Earth, which is his book Tribe. We talk about his latest documentary, which is incredibly powerful, called Hell on Earth. And then we take some looks at this country. So with his perspective of a man who has worked all over the country in wartime, you know, what are the things that we're doing well? And what are some of the things that maybe we could take a step back and do a little better? I did make a mistake. I referred to Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman as Lieutenant Dave Grossman, so please accept my apologies in advance for that. But this was another fantastic interview. As I always say, please make sure that you go to iTunes and rate the show. Give us a 5-star rating, make us as visible as possible to other listeners. And without further ado, I introduce to you Sebastian Junger. Enjoy. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I know when we did our first interviews about a year ago now, you were one of my very first guests. So I want to let you know, firstly, ever since then, I've had multiple guests that the other guests have asked me how I got you. So I think
that's funny.
That's a compliment in itself. But so ever since our last conversation, Tribe is absolutely one of the books that I've recommended to so many people. I've reread it again myself, and the more I read it, the more it resonates in my mind, the more I realize it pertains to not only the fire service, but obviously, you know, our whole culture. So, So since you wrote it, what are some of the reflections you've had and the feedback you've had from the readers?
I mean, mostly people love it. I mean, I've gotten dozens, scores, hundreds maybe of, you know, Facebook messages and what have you of people saying that it made them, reading it made them realize that they're not the one with the problem, that they may be unhappy or unfulfilled or frustrated, but that doesn't stop because they have a problem. They're actually healthy. It's the society around them that's not organized in a way that that's very human. And so, in many, you know, from soldiers, veterans, firemen, you know, surgeons, I mean, a real variety, single moms, you know, what I mean, a whole variety of human beings, like the reaction's been pretty consistent.
Yeah, I mean, I know that my profession has definitely embraced it. And I think one of the areas that they're realizing, that's something that I talk about, is the tribe, as you've said, is very present in a fire station. But I think when people are removed from that tribe in our profession, whether it's retirement or injury or even promotion out of a station into a desk job, that's when we're seeing some of the, you know, the psychological issues that come with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just spoke on Randall Islands at the FDNY training facility. I spoke about trauma, and one of the guys that was there said he was asked in a short internal documentary that they made about how the fire department, how the firemen recovered from 9/11, where they lost 349 firemen, I think.
343.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I'm sorry, 343 firemen they lost, specifically
343,
firemen.
343, right. I knew that. I knew it didn't sound quite right. 343 firemen. And he said the firehouse kitchen, like that was how they processed it. They had a communal place where they gathered to cook meals or what have you, but the healing happened collectively in the firehouse kitchen. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and it is something that we've seen that we've gone away from in the fire service. I sadly was given a realization, this happened before you and I spoke about 2 years ago now, but I've worked in four different stations, and some have been extremely cohesive and very tribal. And when something bad has happened within that department, it's sent a shockwave through the department. this particular one that I'm talking about now, we lost a fireman, and there wasn't a strong sense of tribalism. There's a lot of individuality and selfishness, really. And it was to the point where when we came back from burying this guy, we were told to go and apologize to all the stations because we took too long at his funeral.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yes. So to me, that's just a chronic symptom of what we're talking about. If you don't have that cohesion and that tribal mentality in the fire station, those are the god-awful things that you see as a result.
Well, some stations don't have a television in the common room because they're worried it will disrupt the group interaction, which I think is really smart, actually. But I was with, last weekend, I was with Rescue 2 in Brooklyn, and they're moving from a really classic old firehouse with a big common room, big round table, to a super modern, super expensive, super modern, sort of green energy, like everything, new station that the city built for them. And they're all dreading it. And these guys are living basically in a gym locker, right? I mean, the building they're in right now is just a piece of shit, but it's old and it's theirs and they love it. And they're being offered this gorgeous modern building, and they don't even want to go.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
No, it is. And they're building the new fire stations now with individual dorm rooms as well. So each crew, or maybe even each firefighter, will have their own small room. From a sleep deprivation, that's amazing, because now you're not waking up the entire station every time they get a call. But from, again, a social point of view, now you're getting guys creeping off, taking their tablets, their cell phones, their TVs, and then, you know, not communicating.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely, that's terrible. I mean, seriously, like, that's really bad for mental health. And, you know, you can do without sleep. You can't do without mental health. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, as they say, you know, the hammer if it looks like a nail. But that I'm pretty convinced of that.
Absolutely. All right. So I want to come back on to Tribe as we talk. But I most recently watched Hell on Earth. I know you and I had a brief conversation about that over the over email. But the last time we talked, you were, I think in the editing phase of that. So I wanted to kind of this time dwell into a little bit more of the journalism side as well. There's many blanket statements that we say as a culture. I know I've said it too, which is, you know, the media is killing this country. But then we watch a powerful, powerful documentary like Hell on Earth, which is your latest project. And you realize that, obviously, as with Restrepo and you know, other great films, that the media has a very, very powerful place if it's not abused. So if you don't mind me asking, what is your view of media as a whole? And, you know, what are we doing right and what are we doing wrong in this country?
Well, media reflects the society. I mean, it gives the society what the society is asking for. So, I mean, I would say actually the society is ruining the media. I would put it the other way around. I don't think the media has the capability to ruin the thing it depends on. I think the media is part of a process of sort of cheapening intellectual discourse that is happening throughout the society. But I don't think it's the root cause of it. I think the level of intellectual discourse in Congress right now is abysmal. It's not because the media didn't do that to them. They did that to themselves. Likewise, in liberal campuses, the level of intellectual debate is really being constrained by, you know, American liberal ethos of that almost amounts to a kind of faith-based reasoning. And all of that is just terrible for people. But I think the media, for the most part, with some really tragic, important exceptions, but for the most part, the media is trying to get at an objective truth. And they make mistakes the way doctors make mistakes and meteorologists make mistakes, but they're not actually trying to convince people it's going to rain when actually it's going to be sunny. they're not trying to convince people that they have cancer when they don't, when they really don't. They're honest mistakes. And I would say that the media outlets that adopt an overtly partisan stance, that they're actually not journalism. There's something else. And if they would just call themselves that, we'd all be good, but they're not.
Yeah, I mean, that's an observation I made coming from the UK, growing up there with the BBC, which I'm biased, but I think is a pretty good way of delivering news to the sensationalized, you know, from either sides of the fence, Fox, CNN, whatever one you want to pick on, but where the screen is divided and it's a bunch of idiots just arguing with each other and no actual news is being reported whatsoever.
Well, what's up? There has been a cheapening, definitely, of cable news, and it's turned. I mean, sometimes those debates are really illuminating and interesting, and sometimes they're clearly there for entertainment value. And I think when they do that, the ratings probably go up. I mean, again, the media is giving the public what it wants. And if it was doing that and the ratings went down, trust me, they'd stop doing it. I mean, these are companies with shareholders, right? And the shareholders would get, you know, if nothing else, the shareholders would get upset at the right ratings. So we have to assume that whatever the media is doing, that is the thing that the public most rewards with high ratings.
Like you said.
How do you get, you know, we're not force feeding, media is not force feeding the public anything. It's ratings based. Like, they vote with their feet, right? So the current state of television news right now, I think, is reflective of the population, and that is reflective of educational, you know, like what we're doing in our schools. I mean, if you really teach children about reason, and I mean, it's sort of the beautiful process of reason and logic, like, they don't have any time for that garbage, but we're not teaching children that. I mean, there were apparently classes in logical reasoning were actually banned from some schools in Texas as being antithetical to Christian values. So, you know, check that, but that's my memory. This is about 10 years ago. And, you know, once you start doing that to children, like, forget it. Of course, they're going to devour that garbage on television.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like we're almost, and I'm not the only one that's made this observation, but it almost feels like we're living in idiocracy now, not because the person, you know, or the group that's in power at the moment is wearing a red tie or a blue tie, but just as a nation, as the consumption of reality TV and the mass of commercials that we consume on TV, and
yeah.
You know, the disregard for other countries and what they do and what they're doing better than us in many areas. I mean, you know, it feels like that idiocracy thing. So where do you think, I mean, you're well-versed in not only our culture, but you've been deeply embedded in all these other nations around the world too. What do you think we need to do to move ourselves back to a more positive and productive place?
God, I mean, that's a pretty complex question. I think we have to make... everything depends on everything else, so it's hard to pick one thing and say start with this. But I would say that at the government, I mean Congress, has to decide to value debate and compromise and reason and data. And when they do, they'll fund educational initiatives that emphasize those virtues. And then when children learn those virtues, they'll in turn be able to elect people and make choices in their lives based on reason and not based on faith. And but there seems to be at work in both political parties an idea that you consolidate your base by appealing to their sense of allegiance to a ideology rather than a kind of, you know, process of reasoning. The left is just as bad at it as the right. And the right does it in a kind of Christian-tinged way, and the left does it in a kind of humanism-tinged way, but it's bullshit on both sides. And so I don't, you know, I think we are completely stuck until the government decides to act in an intellectually responsible way. And when George Bush, someone in the Bush administration, dismissed reports that the insurgency in Iraq was getting stronger rather than weaker in 05, 06, something like that. Dismiss those reports as coming from journalists who are stuck in the reality-based world. That was the beginning. That was the beginning of this sort of fantasy realm where there's a parallel reality that just obeys your wishes. And that was reinforced by what's Kellyanne Conway's alternative facts. And, you know, now we have a president, of course, where, you know, pretty clearly, I mean, I happen to be a Democrat, but I imagine there are plenty of smart, sensitive Republicans who would say exactly the same thing. We have a president who clearly has absolutely holds an objective truth that gives absolutely zero value. You say things that give you a tactical advantage, and whether they're true or not is totally irrelevant. And I mean, I almost feel like the president is in the position of like the guy who cheated on his girlfriend and will say absolutely anything that might get him out of the situation. And it has no bearing with whether it's true or not, has absolutely no bearing at whatsoever on what he says. That's the kind of president we feel like we have. And as long as that's true, I mean, he's there because the society has been transformed, and or we wouldn't have elected him. And now he's there, and he's perpetuating. But I think he's going to perpetuate it to a point where there's a crisis and a collapse, and then hopefully it'll sort of renew itself with these other virtues.
Yeah, I mean, I know, again, this isn't a show that normally delves into politics, but I do like to hold a mirror up and take, you know, myself and the listeners into a slightly uncomfortable space. But the bottom line is, again, as an Englishman, as an immigrant, just like Juan Restrepo, you know, an immigrant that came over here to try and make the country better, you see this breakdown in communication with other countries. And I see, as a man that came from a nation that was at war for so long, you know, potential of war, which means, you know, potential of more Americans dying just because of words being thrown around. And as a citizen of the United States, that worries me, because that's unnecessary, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. But my father was an immigrant and a war refugee two times over. And he came into this country when he was 18. And during World War II, he couldn't join the military because he had asthma, and he became a physicist, and he helped this country quite a lot with his science, with his mind, and was very proud and grateful to be an American, but was also very critical of it, of this country. I mean, understandably so.
Yeah, and you have to be. I mean, if you have a desire to make your country great, then, you know, hopefully that there's kindness is kind of, and compassion is driving that, but you know, you're not going to just accept what someone that was elected says as gospel. You're going to always challenge it and hope to grow as a nation. I don't think that's anything bad whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, but that is where these sort of faith-based political ideologies come into play, where they're predicated on the idea that the opposing party is completely wrong in all of its ideas, and not just wrong, but has bad intentions and is deliberately trying to destroy the country. And basically that's a description of an enemy, right? An enemy of the state. And both political parties view the other in those terms. And when you set up a dynamic like that, it is a zero-sum game. It's sort of all or nothing. Either we win Congress or we lose Congress. And there's no idea that actually some of these decisions should be shared, some of the power should be shared. Maybe we'll slosh back and forth a little bit. But, you know, basically, both parties participate in the act of governing and compromise, and some solution is reached, which actually represents the ideas of most Americans, but that's completely gone.
Right. Yeah, because you were saying, I think I heard you in another interview, it might be with Joe Rogan, where you talked about how as a nation we need the Republican ethos and the Democrat ethos, that there's value in both of those, but they need to work together, not try and destroy each other.
Yeah, I mean, the conservatism and liberalism as sort of basic human worldviews are, they're clearly genetically determined. About 50% of our political view is hereditary. And they know this from twin studies. studies of identical twins who have a much higher concordance of clinical opinion than fraternal twins. So that's the genetic component coming into play. And so if that's true, if political opinion really is genetic, that means it was adaptive in our evolutionary past. That conservatism had survival value and liberalism had survival value. So if it's encoded in our DNA, if it's genetic, it's complete nonsense to say that the other side is somehow not only wrong, but immoral and shouldn't exist. I mean, you're just going against evolution. But even to use evolution in an argument is to upset both of these political parties. I mean, you know, the Christian right hates the idea of evolution for obvious reasons. But the sort of humanist left also does, because it feels reductionist and depriving people of free will. So there is a sort of anti-science bias at the extremes of both political parties that is really corrosive to thought.
Right. And it's like so many things, you know, that we see in life where you have the extreme left and you have the extreme right, whether it's, you know, anything, not talking just about politics. And the glaringly obvious thing is, well, somewhere in the middle is probably where we need to be, you know. But right now it seems like we're being drawn further to the extremes instead of just focusing on the middle and saying, well, look, you know, here's the common ground that we should probably be aiming at and taking from the philosophies of both sides.
Yeah, right. And but you know, this sort of dismal new era is actually producing some counter-reactions, some really healthy, beautiful counter-reactions that this sort of reasonable enlightenment of the Obama era, like, that didn't. And one is a group called With Honor, which is a political group that supports the campaigns and funds veterans who are running for congressional seats of both parties. And they have to be supported and funded by this group With Honor. They have to take a sort of vow of bipartisanship that has some very, very specific demands. One of them being that you fraternize, you socialize with people from the other party at least once a week. And that you deliberately try to pass legislation in a bipartisan manner. And the reason they're focusing on veterans is, of course, within the military, political belief has almost no bearing on how people are considered. And the closer you get to the combat, the more that's true. And so what they showed was that bipartisanship was at its peak in Congress when the percentage of veterans in Congress were at their peak. And we're now at our lowest level ever of veterans in Congress, and partisanship is at its worst. So they're drawing the obvious conclusion from that and deciding we need more veterans in Congress, but they have to be bipartisan.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I'd never heard of that before. So
look it up. It's called With Honor, and you can look it up. It's a newly formed group, and it's amazing. I mean, it really is. I mean, tell your listeners to donate. I mean, you know, whatever. Like, it will save the nation from itself.
Yeah, well, I think that we've touched on some political topics just very gently in other episodes when I've had guests, and I've had many guests that have been in special forces, and there's many times they've said that a leader, sometimes the same exact names come up several times, that they wish that would be someone that could be, you know, a candidate for the president, because I mean, you know, these people have walked the walk, they've been through combat, they've led men.
Yeah.
And it's not all about obviously war, but it's more about leadership and understanding the value of a life too.
Yeah, and understanding that that political belief, race, all kinds of sort of identifying factors actually don't matter at the end of the day. That they're not relevant to being a good actor. Meaning acting well in a situation. And the military knows that really well, and so do survivors of disasters. You know, I mean, you know, my book Tribe talks about, you know, people who survive earthquakes and things like that. You know, I mean, the first thing that happens is all those awful social distinctions disappear. You know, rich, poor, white, black, they don't have matters for a while. Ideally, that's how society should run, government should run. But soldiers do have an experience with that that few civilians are fortunate enough to have.
Right. Now, I want to, if you don't mind, kind of go back a little bit. I heard a couple of things in some interviews I listened to with other people that you did and read some of your work as well. I don't think we talked about it in our first interview about some of your earlier assignments when you first... Well, firstly, I want to actually talk about how you did your very first trip in journalism and then some of the other conflicts outside the Middle East that you'd been to first. So could you tell me, you know, when you had that moment where you decided to go into journalism, how you carried that about your very first assignment?
Well, I got out of college and I did construction for a summer and moved down to Washington, D.C. And I'd written a thesis in college. I was a really good distance runner in college and I lived on the Navajo reservation for a summer and wrote an anthropology thesis on Navajo long distance running. And that process of researching and writing was really exciting to me, so I decided I'd be a journalist. And so I went down to Washington, D.C. and got a job at a bar and started freelance writing for the local free weekly paper down there called the City Paper. And I just loved it. You couldn't make a living at it. I would get paid a couple $100 for an article, but it would, for a young person, like, it was incredibly exciting. And I kept doing that, and I kept not being able to make a living, but I was getting published regularly in sort of local newspapers. I moved back up to Boston. I finally got a job as a climber for tree companies, and which was really well paid. It was very dangerous. I worked 50, 80, 100 feet in the air on a rope with a chainsaw taking trees down, you know, from the top down. And I, you know, inevitably I got hurt, and I hit my leg with a chainsaw, tore it up. And as I was recovering, I started thinking about dangerous jobs. Maybe I'll write a book about dangerous jobs. You know, I wanted more than anything to get published. I mean, that would be a book. Maybe I'll write about dangerous jobs. And at that time, a huge storm hit the town I was living in, the town of Gloucester. And it, a storm that pummeled the whole east coast of the United States. And a fishing boat from Gloucester, the town I was living in, was lost off the Grand Banks, the six men. And so I started researching what would become the perfect storm. But while I was doing that, I also became interested in war reporting as another dangerous job. And there was a war in Bosnia. I said, okay, while I'm researching the perfect storm, I'm also going to go to Bosnia and learn how to be a war reporter and learn what that's all about. Maybe I could write about it. You know, I could never sell my book. Maybe I could just become a war reporter. It sounded very sort of sexy and compelling and meaningful and, you know, just exactly what a young man would want. So off I went to Bosnia, and I went to Sarajevo during the war, and like immediately fell in love with the process of war reporting, and just kept doing that. But I was always freelance. I mean, I never had an assignment, right? And so eventually, some years after that, I started getting actual assignments from magazines. I mean, the first one sent me to Afghanistan in 1996. It was an actual magazine assignment that sent me overseas. Like, I was incredibly proud. And I was writing about the Al-Qaeda training camps in Tora Bora, the Tora Bora Mountains of Jalalabad, in the summer of 1996. And right then, the Taliban took over, and I sort of witnessed part of that. And, pretty much hooked me for life on foreign reporting.
Okay, so but if I could scale back for a moment. So just to underline this, because I think this is an amazing point. I think the way you phrased it in that one interview was you threw some notepads and pencils in a backpack and took some money with you, and you basically jumped on a plane and went to Bosnia. So as someone from the outside looking in, we think, well, you're attached to some sort of news network and you're sent there, and then there's a nice safe hotel and you've got a whole bunch of people. But what you're saying is a lot of these correspondents that we're seeing are actually literally out there on their own, just attaching themselves to a unit somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, there was no unit to attach to because there was no U.S. military over there, right? There's just a war situation. It was a civil war, and I flew to Vienna and took the train down to Zagreb, and from Zagreb I got a UN flight eventually into Sarajevo, and a UN relief flight. I got a UN press pass, which got me onto the flight. I got the press pass because I talked to a friend of mine who worked at the magazine, who, like, they had no intention of buying anything I wrote, but he just did me a favor and got me said that I was working for them, right? The UN didn't. Whatever, they couldn't tell, so they gave me a press pass. So off I went to Sarajevo, with a backpack, with a sleeping bag and some notebooks, and, spare change of clothes. That was about it. And that was most of the young people that I met who were working over there were exactly like that. They're mostly men. I did an informal survey. Most of them had just been dumped by their girlfriends. So off they went to war. Some weird male reaction to heartbreak, I think. And, if I'm not going to be with the woman I love, at least I could be in war. At least I'll go to the other direction and experience that. And, it was incredibly exciting.
Wow, so,
incredibly exciting time for me.
So you either get dumped, you join the Foreign Legion, or you become a war correspondent.
Exactly. No, there's a real male archetype there. It's very funny.
Well, so that's why I want to kind of think about what we were talking about at the beginning. So again, that's where I'm really trying to educate myself and people listening too about the difference between some of these media routes that we're seeing. So I don't think our local news weatherman would throw some stuff in a backpack and take himself into a country that's having a civil war with no U.S. presence. So the things that you and your peers are reporting back to us circumnavigate what we're being told by the sensationalist media. Those are the media sources that we need to seek out to really get a true picture painted. And obviously we see that in some of your documentaries as well. Now, I know, staying on Bosnia for a moment, you talked about in Tribe about some of the things you saw as far as how war affected those people. So can you just kind of paint the picture? I mean, we would think that everyone was fleeing for their lives and hiding, but you talk about that wasn't the case in some of these cities.
Yeah. Excuse me. I mean, they were fleeing for their lives and they were hiding, but later after the war, they realized that those were some of the best times of their lives, and that was true because they were extremely cohesive. It was a very cohesive society. Crisis brings out very pro-social behaviors in people, and those behaviors feel good. And so when you look back on, the blizzard of 1978 in Boston, or the flood of 83, or the earthquake, or whatever, I mean, when people look back on these ordeals, they often look back with a lot of nostalgia. And what they're nostalgic about is the fact that in this highly individualized society that we have, a crisis brings on this sort of collective effort, and which is clearly how we were wired to live in our evolutionary past. And that collective effort where people are all serving the community, serving the group rather than themselves, that collective effort feels good. And one of the ironies of war, even for civilians in Sarajevo, was that they lived, they all took shelter in basements of buildings, and they had the little victory gardens and the media strips in their highways, and they had civil defense forces that defended neighborhoods, and all these collective actions that were required by a tragic necessity. But when these people look back, they realize that they liked who they were during the war, that they were better people during the war, and that a lot of civilians in Sarajevo said that they actually missed them afterwards.
Right. Now, was it Sarajevo that you saw your first dead body? I believe you're talking about that in one of your speeches that you did.
No, I'm trying to remember where I saw my first dead body.
You talked about a young lady that was found up on a hill.
Oh, that's Kosovo. Yeah.
Oh, it was Kosovo. Kosovo. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that had a profound effect on me, partly because she was 16 years old and naked and had been gang raped and had her throat cut by Serb paramilitaries. And I'm I'm left wing, I'm anti-war, I'm all that stuff. But, when NATO went in, it started dropping bombs on those guys. It was pretty satisfying.
Yeah, and that's what I've heard from a lot of soldiers that we had on here. Obviously, some of them may not even agree how some of these conflicts were started, but once they get there and they see some of the atrocities that are happening to the people, they have no issue with, taking care of what needs to be done from that perspective, from a humanist perspective, really.
Yeah, I mean, if war is awful, it should be stopped by all means necessary, and sometimes those means include war. World War II would, require military action to be stopped, by the United States. I mean, we entered World War II, thank God, and we least according to my father, saved the world from fascism. So, yeah, war is bad, but sometimes it requires war to bring it to an end. That's the irony of pacifism, is that it ends up being, I mean, complete pacifism, absolute pacifism, ends up being a kind of immoral abdication of responsibility for other people's suffering.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So if you're completely anti-war with no true understanding behind it, that's just as dangerous as being completely pro-war with no true understanding
behind
it. Well,
yeah. Right. I mean, you'll let the Rwandas and Bosnias of the world go on and on and on, as long as you yourself don't taint your moral standing by engaging in organized violence. But that's not really a moral position. And you know, the people that adopt that, who have that attitude, are all living in towns that are where their safety is preserved by a police force that carries guns. I mean, if you're really anti-violence, if you are really truly against the use of any force by the authorities, you really should be protesting in front of your police station, demanding that the police who protect you in your town do not carry guns. You really should be doing that. I mean, it starts with hope, if you really believe that. But obviously, people don't really believe it. It's a political position that's full of holes.
Yeah, well, we protest violence by going to protests and starting violence. So that doesn't send a very good message,
right,
does it?
Right.
All right, well, you just touched on Africa for a second. Another very powerful story. And again, I'm trying to paint the picture of what you and Tim and all the men and women that you worked alongside are doing around this planet to bring these stories to, you know, this extremely lucky, communities that we live in, whether it's England, Australia, America. So can you tell the story about how you thought you were going to die when you were, it was one of the African nations, I forget which one it was.
Both of them. I was in Sierra Leone during the Civil War, and I was coming back from a battle west of Freetown. It was a town called McKinney, if I'm remembering that right. Anyway, I was in the back of a Jeep, driven by a Sierra Leonean soldier, a couple other journalists, and we were stopped by a group of rebels called the West Side Boys that were their own sort of armed group outside of Freetown. And they were an extremely violent group, and they were eventually wiped out by British SAS. But they just stepped into the jungle, out of the jungle, onto the road with their machine guns leveled, and you know, we were just one Jeep, right? And we had no escort, we had nothing. And they got extremely aggressive. They were cocking their guns and leveling their guns. And at one point, it looked like a guy was going to shoot because his buddy standing next to him grabbed the muzzle of the machine gun and jerked it upwards. But I spent about 10 or 15 minutes thinking it was the end of my life. And, a 9-mil got pulled out of someone's holster and put to someone's head. I mean, they're extremely aggressive, and they seem to be arguing about whether to kill us or not. It was Creole. It was the sort of local dialect, which is, when it's spoken fast, is absolutely impossible to understand. So I didn't know what they were saying, but it looked like they were arguing about what to do about us. And eventually they let us go. Maybe they were going to the whole time. I have no idea, but I can tell you that for 10 or 15 minutes, I absolutely thought we were going to be killed, and I was sort of trying to get myself ready for that, whatever that means.
Yeah. Well, again, so you weren't attached to any sort of U.S. forces at that point?
Well, there were none, no. I mean, I was just in Sierra Leone, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, I mean, that's just, we just see, you know, the results, whether it's the writing, the photography, the documentary footage. But when I delve into what you do even more and really start exploring, you know, more than just tribe, which we talked about a lot last time, I just wanted to teach everyone, you know, about photojournalism and war correspondence and what they actually risk just to bring those images back to us, which may in turn help the poor people that they're seeing, you know, being killed.
Yeah, right. That's right. There's a lot of, I mean, I'm no longer doing it, but there's a lot of very brave people out there who are covering wars, and they're almost not compensated financially. And it's very dangerous work, and they'll often get killed. I mean, and they are the eyes and ears of the world. I mean, big networks do cover some of this stuff, but they cover it in part by using freelancers who are on the ground.
Right. Well, so my next question is obviously, you know, so there you were in Eastern Europe, you were in Africa, obviously you're in the Middle East, North Africa. So with your work on tribe and tribalism and obviously your book Before War, what is it about these nations that go to war and the way their communities were before? What do you think is causing these conflicts over and over again around our planet?
I think most wars are probably started by, resource competition, water, food, land. I mean, even with chimpanzees, chimpanzees are the only species that conducts or organized male violence against outsiders. And groups of five or six males will literally go on patrol into enemy territory, and when they encounter lone males from a rival troop, they will beat them to death. And one by one, they'll get rid of all the males, and then they'll move into that territory, kill the infants, rape, so I don't know if you can use the word rape for the animals, but rape the females, adopt the females into their community. And now their group is bigger, and they have more territory, more resources, more food. And that's chimpanzees, right? That's not even humans. That's chimpanzees. So clearly, aggression is rewarded in Darwinian terms and evolutionary terms, and aggression is adaptive. And the more aggressive chimpanzees are the ones who expand their territory and get to mate with more females and produce more offspring. I mean, obviously, there's a genetic reward for that behavior. So in humans, at its most basic level, it's either competition for resources or a kind of predatory aggression that if that were not adaptive, in other words, if it weren't rewarded in Darwinian terms, it would die out. If it was maladaptive, if it caused more harm than good to the people who do it, it would have died out. And so clearly it's something that we're wired for. It's part of the reason there's so many of us. I mean, we're very good at being humans on this planet.
Yeah. Well, you made a great point. Again, another interview. I've absorbed so many of your interviews really to get ready for this this next conversation. But that if evolutionary, if we were predisposed to crumble during times of stress, then we would not be a species anymore. And it was a great point. Every time we're having these disasters, we do seem to thrive and we do seem to regain that sense of community. Do you think that's one of the reasons behind what we're seeing a lot these days is we haven't had many of these things? We haven't been at war on our home soil, whether it's England, Australia, America. I mean, hopefully we don't need to have wars to be better people, but do you think that might be one of the underlying factors of why we've become seemingly more selfish than, say, the World War II generation?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to talk about complex societies in sort of general terms, but basically crisis produces pro-social behavior in people. People act well, they act with consideration for others. And if there's no crisis, evolution, what evolution has done is wired us to concentrate on ourselves. It makes sense. I mean, there was people focusing on their own interests, their own endeavors, that invented the wheel, the bow and arrow, the computer, the binoculars, the whatever. I mean, these things get invented by individuals who are pursuing an interest. And they can only do that when they have some sort of survival space to do it in, and if everything's a constant crisis, they can't. So what you have is this sort of dynamic tension between people pursuing individual interests, which has great benefit to society, but it leads to a sort of like fracturing of the social bonds. And then you have a crisis, which brings everyone together and puts innovation on hold for a little while, but it brings everyone together. So, you know, clearly in our evolutionary past, where you have a dynamic tension between those two behaviors, you have a pretty healthy society. And I think one of the problems with modern society is that there, in some ways, aren't enough crises. There isn't enough hardship. There isn't enough adversity to counteract the naturally individualistic tendencies that we all have. And then when those things do happen, they're rare, but when they do happen, people act as they're programmed to act, which is very, very communally. But modern society has solved a lot of the security and survival problems that our ancestors faced, so we don't need to act communally very often. Yeah, it's a problem. I don't mean it doesn't mean we're all going to die off, but I think it does mean that we have rates of mental illness that are probably higher than in our evolutionary past.
Yeah, well, we're seeing that obviously with the depression rates and the suicide rates. But another thing that we're seeing very recently, and I had an interesting conversation with Lieutenant Dave Grossman. I think it was about a couple of months after we spoke, and his whole view on video games and technology creating some issues with mental health as well. But in the last 30 years, we've seen almost a brand new phenomenon, which is the shooting, the mass shootings. So, from an anthropology point of view, is there any observations you've made about that?
Well, America, there's lots of countries with lots of guns, and every country has crazy people in them, in it. But America seems to be the only country that where people regularly take military-grade weapons and go into the street and kill as many bystanders as possible before dying themselves. I mean, that seems to be a uniquely American pastime. And I don't know what the reason for that is. What's interesting is that usually happens in really middle class, pretty safe, comfortable communities. It's never happened in a high crime urban neighborhood. I mean, there's plenty of other awful stuff that happens, like gang violence. But gang violence makes sense, right? It's not nihilistic. It has a pure logic behind it. Like, it's territorial. They're fighting over resources, drug trade, whatever. I mean, gang violence is completely reasonable. It's tragic, but it makes kind of human sense. Mass shootings of people you do not know, who are not a threat to you and are not rivals of yours, like before you die, like that makes it's completely nihilistic. And it's interesting that it seems to happen in the most alienated communities. For all their stresses, ghettos are not high crime, low income neighborhoods are not alienating. They're all too human. I grew up in an affluent suburb, and I think it's at those kinds of environments where it's hard to feel the connection that you have with the community around you. Like it's hard to even identify that there is a community.
Yeah, well, that's something that you mentioned in our conversation. Obviously, you talk about in Tribe, and I know that you talk of where you live in New York and the building and knowing your neighbors. Well, I actually was recently in a place where we were looking for a new home, and one choice was a kind of mini farm, 5 acres, because we live in Florida, you can afford that. But we actually opted for a housing community that was a very small yard compared to where I've lived before, growing up on a farm. But in lieu of it being around a community pool, playing fields, volleyball courts, and just like you said, the people there, they walk their dogs, they say hello to each other, they, the kids invite
Right,
each other to
right.
play, and it was so refreshing to see. That was my goal behind it, see it actually start to play out now, and it's absolutely amazing. I mean, my sons feel like they are part of a community again,
Right,
and the
right.
change between that and suburban America we were before is completely different.
Oh, I'm really glad to hear that. It doesn't surprise me, but that's wonderful. I'm happy for you guys. I mean, I try to live my life that way too.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lesson learned there. It doesn't matter where you are, and obviously we're kind of crammed into some of these cities that we live in, but if you can make choices to deliberately be in a community, whether it's in your own building or in your street, whatever it is, there's definitely a prehistoric feeling of being part of something again, which is really nice.
Yeah. No, that's really great. That's really great.
Okay, well, I want to transition over to some other things that I've seen on your website now that I'd love to talk about. I think we touched on it maybe just for a moment last time, but the first thing is the Veterans Town Hall. So could you tell us about that and how it's been received so far?
Yeah, so I had this idea from looking at Native American rituals that involved the reincorporation of warriors back into society, that one very healthy process is to have a kind of cathartic gathering where the warrior gets to talk about what he or she obviously did for the community to defend it. did in the name of the community. It's what soldiers, warriors do in the name on behalf of the community includes things that are courageous, but also things that are horrifying, like killing other people. And if you get to sort of talk that through, dance it through, sing it through, whatever your medium is, in front of the community you did those things for, is very cathartic, and it allows or forces the community to participate morally in what you did. They become part of the moral responsibility for those things. So how do you do that in a modern society? It's not organized in a tribal way. Well, the closest thing we have to that kind of communal organization is the town hall, the city hall. I mean, every person in the country has a town or city hall that they're affiliated with, that the community is part of. So I just had the idea that on Veterans Day, that any veteran of any war has the right to speak for 10 minutes to their community about what they did for them. And if you say that you support the troops or whatever, that means showing up and listening for an hour or two, and then you can go home. If you want to go to the parade, that's great, but I don't think parades are very helpful psychologically. So you will get veterans who are enraged about the war that they were made to fight, and that will make patriots uncomfortable, and you'll get veterans who say that joining the military and being in combat was the best thing that ever could have happened to them, and that they miss it. That will make liberals uncomfortable. And there's no better sport than making conservatives and liberals uncomfortable, as far as I'm concerned. And then there's people who will, you know, be crying too hard to even say much of anything at all. And those people will make us all uncomfortable. And, you know, those are the people particularly that we have to listen to. And we did this too. I mean, we asked them to do something for us, and these are the consequences, and we need to be part of it. And so these events have been sort of multiplying. It's been, I think we're on year three now, and now there are probably 50 of them around the country. We started with just one 3 years ago, and now there's probably 50 of them. And hopefully there'll be next year 500, and then 5,000, and eventually I think it would be amazing if that was just what happened in every town on Veterans Day, some encounter like this between the civilians and the veterans.
Brilliant. Now, so if someone wanted to do more than just fly a flag on Veterans Day and truly make a difference and show their appreciation, how do they go about getting one of these going in their own town?
Well, if you go to my website, which is sebastianyounger.com, Sebastian with a J-U-N-G-E-R is the last name, .com. You can click on a page called Veterans Town Hall, and it tells you exactly how to do it. It's extremely simple. I mean, you basically have to get the guy that, like, locks up Town Hall in the evening to come by and unlock Town Hall and get the audiovisual guy to turn on the loudspeaker system. And that's it. It doesn't cost a dime. Mostly you have to get the word out to the veteran community and the rest of the town. This is happening. You need to come. You need to come to speak if you're a veteran. You need to come to listen if you're a townsperson. And so that sort of publicity part of it is probably the most difficult of the whole thing, but it's not hard.
Okay, well, I'm going to try and get that going in my town here in Ocala, because I know there's a strong sense of community where I live. I'm very proud of living here, and I'm pretty sure they would be open to it if we proposed it. So I'm going to try and spearhead that myself, and I can put it on social media, our little journey of getting that going as well.
Awesome. That's fantastic. That's really, thank you. That's really great.
No problem. Now, there's a couple other things I want to talk about. So the next one would be your RISC project, RISC. Now, being, a fireman and a paramedic, we have our own version of this already, but can you tell me about why that was started and what it is, what the program involves?
Yeah, my friend and colleague, Tim Hetherington, was killed in Misrata, Libya, covering the Civil War. I was supposed to be with him on assignment, and the last minute I couldn't go. And he died. He was hit by a mortar fragment, and he died. He just bled out in the back of a rebel pickup truck, and none of the journalists around knew what to do. Apply high pressure to the wound, et cetera. And like none of them did that, and he might have lived a bit known. So I started a medical training program. It's a nonprofit to train experienced freelance war reporters in sort of first responder frontline medicine. And we train 72 people a year. We've been doing it since 2012. And, we've really started to work our way through the freelance war reporter population of the world. We've trained up a lot of people.
Right. That's fantastic. Because, I mean, I'm assuming that there might be opportunities for them to not only save them, each other as far as journalists, but also soldiers if they get hit close to them.
Yeah, or civilians. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. All right. And then the next thing, the Half King Bar and Restaurant. When did you start that up?
My friends and I built it in 2000. I was had his partners, another war reporter friend of mine, and his girlfriend, and then another guy. And it was for people that were sort of focusing on journalists and authors, filmmakers, as a place for them to meet. But it's also was very much part of the community, Chelsea part of New York. So it's been going ever since, almost 20 years.
Fantastic. I'm actually supposed to be up in New York in February to go upstate to ski for a little bit. So I'm going to see if I can fit that in my visit, if you'll accept podcasters.
yes. We it's hard to keep them from going in. So yes, no, absolutely. I hope you get there.
Fantastic. All right. Well, your local project, your latest project was something that you, as I said, you were starting when we spoke last. Now, it's called Hell on Earth. It focuses on the conflict in Syria. So firstly, before we talk about Syria, if my memory serves me right, you didn't actually shoot the footage on this one. You weren't embedded, were you? But you were editing the footage that you were given. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, going into Syria was a sort of suicide mission for a Western reporter after a certain point. So we worked with Syrians who were documenting their own civil war, and we got to get them cameras and tell them what we were looking for, and they shot for us. We made the film primarily out of that kind of material.
Okay, so if you wouldn't mind, can you give us a very brief overview of the precursor to the conflict and then where they're at now? Because it was completely educational to me, but I think if I try to relay it or repeat it, I think I'd get it all wrong.
Yeah, so the like the other Arab Spring countries, the war in Syria started as popular protests against corruption and oppression by a dictator, Bashar al-Assad, in the case of Syria. They were protesting police abuse of children and the crushing of dissent with lethal force. And those protests were suppressed violently by the authorities. And eventually the population rose up. They got weapons and they started fighting back. And in that chaos, ISIS, the so-called Islamic States, eventually rose up and started to dominate the battlefield. Russia came in, Iran came in, and now Assad is firmly back in power. ISIS has been crushed, and the country is still at civil war, but I think it's sort of the levels of violence have come down since a few years ago.
Right. I actually met the Syrian. He was a family member of one of my patients, and he was giving me a backstory, and he was optimistic that the country was going to, I wouldn't say be better off under Assad, but at least all those multiple factions and ISIS coming in, by removing them, there was the possibility of some of the conflict diminishing a little bit. Do you think that's correct?
Yeah, I think so. But then, it's going to go back to what it was before, which is horrible. I mean, Assad's a horrible, horrible man. And he runs a sadistic and oppressive police state that has tortured many thousands of people to death through dissent. And so, yeah, we'll go back to that. That's what is that.
And are there any other options aside from him? Are there any people that might be able to get into power traditionally?
I mean, no, he's got Russia and Iran behind him. So with the allies, for the allies like that, you're not going to. I mean, he won't be toppled from power. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's and this is the problem is that these dictators, if they're backed by outside powers, they stay in place for their whole lives. And you know, ultimately, I think that a responsible foreign policy actively penalizes corruption and oppression of the sort that Assad perpetrated. But you know, the U.S. isn't particularly oriented like that, so you know, we're not helping matters much either. In other countries.
Yeah. Now, why is Russia and some of the other countries supporting him?
Well, it's a strategic decision on their part. Russia has a port on the Mediterranean in Syria that they don't want to lose. And Iran wants a land bridge to the Mediterranean, which they now have. Just for strategic, not moral reasons, for strategic reasons, they're for supporting him.
Right. Now, one of the things that was most striking about the documentary Hell on Earth that you released was the graphic nature of the footage, but without being gratuitous. And it kind of paralleled to, I let my little boy watch Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers recently because he was in the War is Glorious kind of phase. And it was just to show him, okay, that it's not as pretty as you think it is in your mind. And I thought that was, again, it was so pertinent in your documentary because you had to see those images of these poor civilians, you know, the collateral damage, especially the children, to really grasp the concept of what was happening while these people were fighting.
Yeah. War is, it's everything. It's a lot of things. It's everything. It's very compelling. It can be very romantic. It can be very scary. It can be very horrifying. I mean, it's sort of everything. And, depending on the war movie, you will or won't see that portrayed. But it's important to understand that all of it is what war is. And the people who are against war won't acknowledge that there's some very compelling things that happen at war. And the people that are sort of more likely to support it really don't want to acknowledge the incredible loss of life and suffering and the cost of war. They just don't want to talk.
My last question then, Sebastian, thank you so much for being so generous with your time again for the second time. So what will be the next project coming from you?
I don't know about the next big project. Right now I was asked by the New York Times to write an op-ed about what it means to be a man in the 21st century, which is obviously a very complicated and a loaded topic. So I'm wrestling with that one. But as far as a big project, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, again, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And I look forward to visiting your restaurant, hopefully in a couple of months, and talking to you again in the future.
Oh, I look forward to it.